Good morning. Well, it's a beautiful snowy day out there. I know it's inconvenient, it causes a lot of trouble, but it's beautiful. I love the snow. For folks listening to the podcast, let me set the scene. We had 17 inches of snow in Minneapolis last night, and so we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. About 14 people here in the Zendo, fewer than we usually have. We have the most intrepid students of the Dharma this morning. Thanks so much for coming. This morning, I'm going to quote quite a lot from Robert Aitken, who is a Zen teacher, whom many of you have read, I think. He just died this last August at the age of 92 or 93. He co-founded the Diamond Sangha in Honolulu. And he wrote this book called Taking the Path of Zen, which is a really good introductory book for Zen. And I keep coming back to it, too. It's not just introductory. And he's written many other books as well, about many different subjects. And Aitken said, "I have heard that someone asked Sasaki Joshu Roshi, what of Zen is necessary to preserve? And he replied, posture and the breathing. I think," now this is Aitken talking here, "I think I might say simply posture, that posture is the one thing that is necessary to preserve from Zen." Posture has been a difficult thing for me. I suppose it's probably difficult for everyone. When I first started doing this practice, I think it was about 18 years ago, at the Ann Arbor Zen Temple, they had 25-minute sittings there. And I can remember just having a terrible time getting through those 25-minute sittings. And usually the problem was my legs. I just couldn't find a way to sit without having pain in my legs and needing to shift at some point during the sitting. And then when I came here in 1993, there were 30-minute sittings. Same thing. I went to Sesshins, retreats. And for quite a while there, I still couldn't get through a 30-minute sitting without moving my legs or shifting in some way. And I felt a little sorry for the people who sat next to me. But they were probably more understanding than I knew. So eventually I settled on a quarter lotus position. It took me a long time to find it. And was able to sit for the entire 30-minute sitting, and then for several 30-minute sittings. And gradually my stamina and my flexibility have increased. But it's still difficult. I still have difficulties. And besides that, quite a few years ago, several years ago, I had an automobile accident. And in this accident, I had a back injury, and I have a long muscle beside my spine on the left side, which just kind of went into spasm and stayed there for a few years and would give me pain every time I sat. And I've had various kinds of work done on this, and it still bothers me. So that's something I've had to contend with. For the first year after the auto accident, I had to sit in a chair. I could not sit unsupported. And then on a retreat, between sittings, I would just lie flat on my back rather than doing kinhin, because that's what my back needed. And after a year, I got back on the cushion and started for short periods of time and came back, and I'm a lot better, but still have some trouble. We just completed our Rohatsu retreat, which was a 7-day meditation retreat, and a number of us were there, did anywhere from 1 to 7 days. And I spent quite a lot of that time in a chair. The question is, that I'd like to throw out is why did I decide to give this talk? Why talk about posture? Well, I've taught a lot of introductory classes over the years. I do an intro here once a month. Always when I do an intro, I talk a little bit about posture because part of the intro is how to sit, how to meditate. So I do a little bit on posture. And perhaps because of the difficulties I've had with posture, I'm very gentle when I talk about posture. You know, there's kind of a range of teaching about posture. You can be really strict about posture, or you can be pretty gentle and pretty forgiving. And I'm way over here on the gentle and forgiving end of this continuum. So usually I just have a few minutes to do this, so I'll demonstrate the various positions. I'll demonstrate the lotus positions, which I'm going to talk a little bit more about later this morning. I demonstrate the Burmese position. I don't know if you can see me too well behind this lectern, but the Burmese position is when you have both of your legs flat on your zabutan. And this is kind of easy on the knees. And this is best done with a very low cushion. Not many people do this here, but I know a guy who did this position for an entire week, Sashin, and he had a cushion about 1 inch thick that was just under his spine. It seemed to work very well for him. And I demonstrate Seiza, which I think most of you know about. And you see, Seiza is like this, where you turn your zafu on its end and straddle it. And I like to use this position for a 40-minute sit because in a 30-minute sit, if I sit in the quarter lotus position, my legs tend to fall asleep, and all I can think about is how much my legs hurt, which is really not very helpful, and that isn't what it needs to be about. And then I always notice some people. The natural tendency is to kind of plop, if you've never done this, is to plop down in the middle of your zafu and kind of cross your legs in a, I forget what this position is called. Aitken has a word for it. But just kind of crossing your legs. Aitken calls this the most desperately uncomfortable position. And I warn people, I say, you can sit that way if you want, but I think it's going to give you back problems. It's going to be hard. And I always talk about finding what works for you, because there are a lot of different positions. Some will work, some will not. Just try different things. It may take you a long time. And be gentle with yourself. If you're here and you start out in one position, it's a 30-minute sit, and you're in agony after 10 minutes, by all means, move. Just very quietly move to a different position. Even if everyone around you is just seems to be stone silent, go ahead and do that. They'll understand. They were new at one point, too. Because you don't want to be so hard on yourself that you'll kind of defeat yourself and just say, well, I can't do this practice. There has to be a way. And if you sit in a chair always, that's just fine. That's just fine. So, but it occurred to me recently that this is really only about half the story. It's advice for beginners. And although it's true you do have to be very gentle with your posture, I really believe that, but posture is so important that when you continue with this practice, when you've been doing it for a while, you really need to become quite disciplined and you need to have quite good posture. I think that's quite important. So that's why I wanted to give this talk. I wanted to go a little beyond what I've always said in the introduction. So, how do I know this? How do I know that posture is important? This talk is entitled The Importance of Posture. I know it because of experts. You know, Robert Aitken talks about it quite a lot, about how important it is. And I know it from personal experience. The moments I've had of greatest clarity, we might say, of greatest being awake, really transformational moments. In those moments, I feel something happens and my posture becomes perfect. At least it feels perfect to me. My back becomes really perfectly straight, and I kind of elongate a bit. And it doesn't feel that I am trying to make this happen. Rather, it feels like something is kind of rising up in me, that something is supporting me, something is lifting me. And not only that, but the posture and the feeling of clarity are really inseparable, to the point where I don't know which is which. I don't know where the mental clarity begins and the physical aspects end. And I can't say that the posture causes the clarity or that the clarity causes the posture. They are the same. And small things about posture, I think, can have enormous significance. Last year at Rohatsu, I was sitting in my usual way, and at some point I realized during Rohatsu that my right arm was sagging a little bit. My left arm was in this kind of nice plane with the rest of my body, and my right arm was kind of dropping a little bit. And after several days, when I got to my time of greatest clarity during that Rohatsu, this arm just kind of naturally came up, and it moved a couple inches. And that may seem like a very small thing, a very insignificant thing, but that little adjustment was part of something really quite transformational. And it wasn't that I moved the arm in order to make this happen, it's just that things came into balance at that point. This little adjustment of posture seemed huge for me. It seemed huge. And not too long ago, I realized that as I was holding my hands like this in this cosmic mudra, I realized that the last two fingers were kind of relaxing a little bit and lifting up a little bit. And seems like a very insignificant thing, but when I put those fingers down, it caused an adjustment, and it caused my back to become really quite a lot straighter. And it helped my meditation tremendously. So I don't mean to say I have good posture all of the time. I get tired sometimes. I have pain sometimes, and I sag. But I work at it, and I see how important it is. I also know that posture is important because of Dogen. And many of you know quite a lot about Dogen, and I'm sure many of you don't. Dogen lived in Japan and was born in the year 1200, and he was the founder of the Soto Zen School, which is our school of Zen. And we'll study him during the spring practice period. And he wrote a lot of stuff that we still use today, that we still use as a guideline. And one thing Dogen said, it's on your brochure here, Dogen said, Zazen is itself enlightenment. Zazen is itself enlightenment. And I'm thinking, how could it be otherwise? As I say this, I'm looking at little Harry. We have a baby here this morning. Just looking joyful and just so totally in the moment. I'm thinking, how can Zazen be other than enlightenment? Enlightenment is being in the moment. It's being with just what's here. You know, and enlightenment is not sort of a special place you go somewhere up in the sky. Enlightenment is just this. It is just this moment. So if Zazen is itself enlightenment and posture is inseparable from what occurs during meditation, then posture is really essential to this practice, and we cannot approach it casually. So we are kind to ourselves, but within that world of kindness toward ourselves, we also try to be very disciplined. And I think the two can work at the same time. You know, you do this when you're ready. You know, you're kind to yourself. Maybe you're not ready to be really disciplined. But you do what you can do when you can do it. Aitken says, at any Zen center worthy of the name, no one will rush you. And that's true. No one ever gets rushed here. You come to this stuff when you're ready. You know, the teaching is here. We tell you what to do. And maybe your tolerance for sitting is 5 minutes a day. Maybe you can't tolerate sitting at all. Maybe you only do walking meditation. But whatever it is, we encourage you, and we want you to give it your whole heart. For that time, you can do it. And maybe you can do much more, and that's great. Do what you can do. But you have to get there. And there is the view about being very disciplined. I found an article by Sojun Roshi, who from the Berkeley Zen Center. It's from a talk he gave on the fourth day of Rohatsu. They have Rohatsu there as well. And a student asked him a question. The student said, "When I cross my legs like this, I just get such tremendous pain. What should I do?" And he says, "Is it better to uncross your legs than to fight it?" And Sojun Roshi says, "No, it's better to fight it than to uncross your legs. Otherwise, you will never find your way. You have to go through your battles. This is sometimes called the battleground of the heart and mind. You have to go through your battles until you give up and let go. So let your mind follow your breath. The first thing is posture. Establish your posture. Really put effort into posture, and then let the mind follow the breath as the rising and falling of your lower abdomen. So, and I think we all know that at some point we have to do what's really hard. I think that may be what brought us here. I think people tend to come to Zen Center because they're ready for that deep thing, you know, for that great challenge, you know. Why do people climb mountains, you know? There's something that they think something's going to happen on that mountain, that they're going to be so challenged they're going to kind of find out what they're made of, you know. And this practice is like that a bit. This practice can be very challenging, and because it's very challenging, incredibly transformative. So Dogen wrote something called the Universal Recommendations for Zazen, the Fukan Zazengi, and some of us know this very well. Because sometimes on retreat, we will chant this at the end of the day. It's a chant which takes about 10 minutes to do, and it basically says how to do Zazen. And he wrote this in sometime in the 1200s, and we still use it as a guide. And I'd just like to go through this a little bit to talk about sort of the proper method of posture, at least his recommendation. He says, at the site of your regular sitting, spread out a thick mat and place a cushion above it. So, at the site of your regular sitting, he's telling us there we should sit regularly and that we should have a certain place that we designate for sitting. And we have the thick mat and the cushion. We're still using these 800 years later. He says, sit either in the full lotus or half lotus position. In the full lotus position, first place your right foot on your left thigh. Right foot on your left thigh. Here we go. Now, this is not the full lotus yet. If I were to bring this foot up here and place it here, this would be the full lotus. I'm not going to do that today because it would cause problems. When I was younger, I could do that pretty well. And I wish I had kept it up, but I haven't. But, okay, that would be full lotus. Then your left foot on your right thigh. In the half lotus, simply place your left foot against your right thigh. Okay? So that's this. I can do this for short periods of time. Now, he stops there. He doesn't talk about the quarter lotus. I suppose in Dogen's day, no one did the quarter lotus. But nowadays, people do. Aitken calls it the incomplete half lotus. And what that is when you just bring this foot down here rather than putting it up on your thigh. And this one works very well for me. And I don't think it really matters which leg you put on the bottom. I sometimes switch back and forth during Sesshin. Then he says, wear your clothes and belt loose and arranged neatly. Then place your right hand on your left leg and your left palm facing upward on the right palm, thumb tips touching. Now, this is a very good way to place your hands. This is the way that is encouraged here. Thumb tips touching like this. This is what Aitken calls a mirror of your concentration. I actually usually touch my thumbnails for a little greater precision. If you sit in this way, if you hold your hands in this way, you can tell when your concentration begins to sag, because if your mental concentration begins to sag, your thumbs may relax like this, and you can tell what you're doing. Holding your hands like this can be very helpful. And as I said before, when I realized I was letting a couple of my fingers kind of get out of line, it really had an effect there. He says, thus sit upright. Oh, but I need to talk a little bit about arms. Now, I'm holding my hands up like this so that you can see, but it's not really a good way to sit. I've been sitting like this for quite a while. For quite a while, I've been sitting with my hands up like this, unsupported, and I've recently been admonished rather severely not to do this anymore by a person who's very familiar with my own back problem, who said, you are really aggravating your back problem by holding your hands up like this, and you need to have some support for them. And, you know, Aitken says, put your hands in your lap. So do not hold your hands up here. Unsupported, that just puts an unnecessary strain. You can put your hands down in your lap like this, so they're supported. If you want, you could probably get a little cushion or pillow or something to lift them up a little higher. That would work too. So, he says, thus sit upright with posture straight, neither inclining to the left or the right, neither leaning forward or backward. So, how do we sit with our back? Aitken says, use the natural curve of your spine. Your spine should curve forward slightly at the waist. Your stomach should be allowed to hang out naturally while your posterior is thrust back for solid support. So the goal is not to be perfectly straight. It's to use the natural curve of your spine. And he says this thing here about a baby, and this is especially appropriate since we have a baby in the audience today. So, who is not yet one, I think. But we may take our model from the posture of a one-year-old baby. The child sits bolt upright with spine curving forward slightly at the waist rather than completely straight up and down. The belly sticks out in front while the rear end sticks out behind. Sitting with the spine completely straight at this age would be impossible, as the muscles are still underdeveloped, too weak to hold the body erect. Curved forward, the vertebrae are locked into their strongest position, and the child can forget about staying erect. And there he is, sitting up. Oh. Oh, I'm sorry. Where was I? Align your ears with your shoulders and your nose with your navel. Place your tongue against the roof of your mouth with teeth and lips both shut. I was told by my first teacher, Haju from Ann Arbor, that the reason we put the tongue at the top of our mouth is it helps with saliva, that we don't spend so much of our time swallowing. And I don't know if that's really true. I know in the beginning I swallowed a lot. I just was very conscious of swallowing a lot. And I don't much anymore. So I don't know if that's a result of putting my tongue in the proper place or not. And then he says, always keep your eyes gently open and breathe softly through your nose. Always keep your eyes gently open. And I kind of wondered what he meant by gently open, so I checked a couple other translations. One just says keep your eyes open. Another said keep them slightly open. So I think what he's telling us is just to keep them open a little bit. My first teacher told me, keep your eyes open just enough to let a little bit of light in. If you open them wide, you may be distracted. If you close them all the way, you may get sleepy. So just let in a little bit of light. And Aitken says the same thing. So, having said all this, I can't say that Dogen's exact method will work for you. I would urge you to give it a try because it's been tested through so many years. I suggest that you strive to follow it, keeping in mind the needs of your own body, and do your best. Give it a good try. Aitken says about this particular posture, the heart of Zen training is Zazen. Without Zazen, there is no Zen, no realization, and no application of the practice. It has its roots in earliest Vedic times and was probably well established by Shakyamuni's day. It has since been refined by trial and error in countless training centers through some 90 generations of Zen teachers. By now, its form is well established. So it's not just something that kind of got pulled out of the air. It's something that's been done for generations and generations. It is tried and tested. Yet, Aitken continues, the mind remains vast and creative. Words of our ancestors in the Dharma turn out to be helpful, but the way itself is still guided by experiment. Again, take into account your own needs. Find the middle way. Actually, in Zen, we don't talk about posture all that much. It's probably fairly unusual to have a Dharma talk about posture. And there are a couple of reasons why. One I've already alluded to, because we don't want you to be rigid about it. But the other is that we don't want you to get hung up on it. We don't want you to get hung up on doing this like it was a project. In Zen, we don't like to give you projects. Because of the you. If we give you a project, then it may be that you begin to think, well, this is what I need to accomplish, this is my next step. And it kind of reinforces, it can reinforce the idea of self rather than helping you to let go of self. And that's why I think some Zen teachers give very little instruction at all. They might just point you to the wall and say, sit there, and that's about it. And I've heard many tales of monks who have gone to a monastery for a year and never gotten any instruction whatsoever. And I think that's because the teacher does not want to give the student anything to grab onto, nothing that might be considered something to be accomplished, a program. Because anytime you're doing that, you're kind of building up that self, while this practice is really about no self. So I think it's okay. I think it's fine to give instruction, fairly extensive instruction. There are different kinds of Zen teachers, and some give none, some give a lot. I think that's fine. I think it's great that there's a variety. But I must say, you know, it's kind of to go with what I've already said is please don't do this with a goal in mind, because if you're trying to get something from your practice, trying to accomplish something in your practice, you just won't come to that place of openness and letting go of wanting. We're trying to let go of wanting, trying to let go of doing things. And that's why I put on the program this wonderful quote from Aitken about how Zazen is not merely a means any more than eating, sleeping, or hugging your children are means or method. When you hug your child, you don't do it with a purpose in mind, like, I need to hug my child so he or she will have a better self-image. I mean, you might do that, but if that's all the reason you're hugging your children, you know, that's a little sad. You should just hug them just to hug them. And there's no place to go there. The act itself is a complete fulfillment of what this life is about. Zazen is the same way. The unity of ends and means, effect and cause, is the way of the Buddha. So, do the meditation just to do the meditation. Zazen itself is enlightenment. There's no place to go. And the Fukan Zazengi says at one point, have no designs on becoming a Buddha. Have no designs on becoming a Buddha. This is something that I have forgotten over and over in my life. I often forget this just before retreat. I can remember my first week-long retreat, I couldn't help but have these thoughts like, well, I've got 1 week here to get enlightened, so I'd better get busy, you know. And really going into it thinking, well, I have to achieve a state of quiet here. And what an impediment that was. That first week-long retreat, that occurred, I think, in the mid-90s, and it was at Hokyoji. Hokyoji is a country retreat in southeastern Minnesota where you can go for extended periods of time. And there used to be a June retreat there annually, a one-week retreat led by Shahaku Okamura. And a lot of people came from far away, Indiana, Kansas, really a great bunch of people. And I went there, and I remember having a very hard time. And it was the fifth day of the retreat, I think. And I was just a mess. I was so worn down, because it's hard. I was worn down. And I just wanted to... I was just ready to give up. You know, I just wanted to get the hell out of there and have a beer and put on some country music or something. You know, anything but this. And it was in this state that I approached the job assignment list. And on the job assignment list, it said Ted Doan. And my heart sank. Because Doan, I had never been Doan. And it's a job that Paul is our Doan today. In retreat, it's a job that goes on all day, and there are many, many things to remember and many things to do at precisely the right time. This wasn't being service Doan. I wasn't leading chants or anything, but it still seemed really daunting to me because you have to get all the bells right at all the right times. At one point, you go out to the big bell outside in the morning, and you ring it 18 times, 30 seconds apart. And there are all these, you open the door for the doshi at the proper time, close it at the proper time, light all the candles, just a lot of things to remember. And I remember looking at that and thinking, I can't do this, I'm just a mess, you know. And what am I going to do? So my options were basically, you know, to leave, well, I can't do that. To say, well, I can't be Doan, yeah, I can't do that. So my only option is to do it. So I thought, if I'm going to do this thing tomorrow, I just have to get my focus together. You know, I have to pull myself together. So I got some instruction in the evening, and at 9 o'clock I went to my tent, and I thought, okay, I need to focus. I'm going to start with my tent. So I did. I went into my tent, and it's all in disarray, you know. And so I start putting it in order. I start putting things away. I fold things up. I sweep the bottom of the tent because I brought in all of this grass, you know. And I think I set up a little altar. I had a little Buddha with me. I got some firewood and kind of put it, made a little altar out of it and put the Buddha on there, and I think I brought in some little flowers, and I was just doing all this stuff one thing at a time because I needed to pull myself together for being Doan the next day. And the next day I show up to be Doan and I concentrate on what I'm doing and really do my best. When it would come time for a sitting, I would begin with thinking, okay, what do I have to do next? Go through it in my mind a couple of times, and then just let it go and wait. Just basically sit there and wait for the time when I'd have to do these next duties. And so I went through the day that way. And finally I rang the last bell at the end of the day. And you know what? I did a perfect job as Doan that day. I do believe there was not one error that day. I don't think I've ever done that since. And I knew it was true because the guy who trained me came rushing over to me after the last bell and said, I didn't think it could be done. So then I went outside. And, you know, I went outside and the stars were bright and the coyotes were howling and the grass was wet. And I walked over to my tent, my very orderly tent, and continued to have an orderly mind and an orderly tent, and realized that I was very, very highly focused now, that I was a world away from where I had been 24 hours ago. And you know why that happened? It's because I had no designs on becoming a Buddha, because I had forgotten all about trying to accomplish something spiritually. I had only been concentrating on doing this job perfectly. And I remember another story that my first teacher, Haju, told me. It's amazing how what an influence one's first teacher has on you. She was my teacher for a year, and I've been repeating things she's told me ever since. And I remember she told this story at the last session of the introductory series. And the story was something about a young monk has a teacher, and the teacher tells the monk to set up a cooking pot and to do it in a certain way, and gave the young monk very precise instructions. And the student set it up and thought he did a pretty good job. And the teacher, in response, kicked it over. So the student thought, well, I guess I didn't do it right. I'll try harder. And he tried really, really hard, and he set it up, and the teacher kicked it over. And this happened several times, something like 10 times. Finally, the student thinks, well, I give up. There's no pleasing this guy. I'm not even going to try. I'm just going to set the thing up. I'm going to do it the way that I think it should be done, the way that feels right to me, and that's just what I'm going to do. So he sets it up, and this time the teacher doesn't kick it over. Because he did it with no goal in mind. He wasn't trying to please anyone. He wasn't trying to accomplish anything. He just set up the pot. So that's our approach to Zazen. Have no designs on becoming a Buddha. So just to finish up, I'd like to say that if I was fortunate to be Doan, because Doan gave me something to concentrate on and to forget about trying to get something, then I have been super fortunate in the past year to be Eno, because Eno is kind of like Doan squared, or Doan cubed, or Doan to the fourth power. Eno is the job where you're responsible for making sure everyone fills all the volunteer positions here at Zen Center. You plan all the retreats, and you work out all the details. You have many, many logistical details to deal with throughout the year. And I'm almost done now. I'll be done January 1st, and Ben will be taking over as Eno, and Marty will be his assistant, and I know they're going to do a great job. And it's been a great experience being Eno. I've gotten to know a lot of people better. I've gotten to know kind of how this place works and how many people make effort going into this, what it takes to run this place. And I am awed by the amount of effort that people put into this place. I have this list. This is usually posted on a little back bulletin board we have here called Who Does What at MZMC. And it's a long piece of paper, and it lists all of the volunteer jobs. Teachers, priests, program coordinator, attendants, intro instructors, greeters, doans, doshi, evening doshi, library, many, many things. There's something like 100 positions listed here, things like Tuesday night doan and things like that. And I counted up the names, and I did it rather quickly, so this is not exact, but I think there are over 40 names on here, over 40 people who hold official positions who are doing things here. And I guess my one regret as Eno is that I probably have not gotten to every single one of these people to just say how much I appreciate their work as volunteers. And, kind of as a representative of the Sangha, how much I appreciate their work. That it is just so heartwarming to know that so many people care so much about this place. Eric Storley came to Rohatsu for 7 days. He's one of the old timers here, one of the founders of the temple. And at the end, at tea, he said, I remember standing out on that porch 35 years ago and saying, I think we should buy this building. And he said how wonderful it was, how much it warmed his heart to know that we're carrying on Katagiri's teachings 35 years later. And what could be better? What could be more fine than to carry on these teachings, which have done so much to make this world better? And so as someone who's leaving this Eno position, I would just like to acknowledge that it's such a beautiful thing, and so much love goes into this place. And this is such a beautiful community. And thank you all. So beautiful that even on a heavy snow day, we have a pretty good crowd here. So are there any, would anyone like to ask a question or make a comment? Well, okay then. Thanks so much for coming. Stick around. We'll see if we can put together some snacks, some tea perhaps. We might. We're a little short-handed this morning, so I'm not sure what the status is of the kitchen situation. All right. Thank you.